From the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, this is Audiophiles. I'm your host, Ellie Yu. In 1941, Woody Guthrie released his song Pastures of Plenty. It describes a land full of promise and opportunity, but it also highlights the hardships of working the land in the Depression-era Dust Bowl. In this show, we explore the modern-day pastures of plenty. We'll hear from fishermen who cast their poles into the water right here in New York City.
There's a nice variety of fish that hits here. You catch fluke, catch striped bass, you catch bluefish.
And we'll hear from a family in Georgia who showed their southern hospitality by sharing their valuable farmland.
This land has been in my name, I mean, 7 generations.
Plus, Americana band Eastbound Jesus joins us in the studio for a live performance.
Yes, I'm fishing and my baby going fishing to play the blues.
You can find a restaurant in nearly every corner in New York City, but you might not realize that the waterways surrounding the city are full of food, too. Many people set up their fishing poles on the piers along the East and Hudson Rivers for their daily catch, and not surprisingly, all that food may not be safe to eat. Reporter Jillian Eugenios went fishing for city residents who are taking chances nonetheless.
Most people see a pretty landscape in the rivers surrounding the island of Manhattan. But fishermen and those who spend serious time on the water have a different view into an unseen world just below the surface.
If you stand back and really think about it, the river is a wilderness all around New York City.
That's John Lipscomb, and he loves the Hudson. When he looks out at the river, he sees a vast expanse of possibility.
It's like having the Serengeti or the North Slope of Alaska right at the end of 45th Street.
Lipscomb is the Hudson River keeper. That means he spends his work days patrolling and checking the water quality. He often spots people fishing for food, which worries him.
From shore, you'll see, you know, a man or a woman sitting on a 5-gallon spackle pail with a minimum of fishing gear, and I'm pretty sure that it's for consumption. And here you have the New York State Health Advisory, which I'm not sure reaches that community. It's largely minority people that I see fishing.
Oh, wow!
There are 12 men fishing off the pier at East 67th Street. Miguel Perez is one of them, and he's not afraid of eating the fish. He and his friends had a dozen poles dangling lines into the East River.
There's a nice variety of fish that hits here. You catch fluke, catch striped bass, you catch bluefish. You catch a fish right now that's hitting on this side, that's called the Virginia spots, that grow approximately 5 inches, but they've been coming in 8 to 10 inches. They're very good fried, a lot of bones, but very tasty.
Tasty, but not always safe.
One of the primary sources of mercury exposure in the human body is through consumption of fish and seafood.
Dr. Laura Geer is a doctor of public health at SUNY Downstate Medical Center.
Mercury is a natural element that is contained in the emissions when you burn coal or fossil fuel combustion. It gets into the atmosphere. It can travel very far in the atmosphere. Then it settles into our waterways,
where it gets consumed by small organisms in the water that then get eaten up by bigger organisms.
And as you go up the food chain, that mercury biomagnifies, so you have a much higher concentration in the larger fish.
The official word from the New York State Department of Health is that fish here are too dangerous for most people to eat. Men can eat a limited amount of fish from the river without harm, but kids and women of childbearing age shouldn't eat any, or serious mercury-related neurological problems could arise. Dr. Geer says the city does make an effort to keep people informed.
For example, the City Department of Health has a beautiful pamphlet that shows you which type of fish you should be eating and which type of fish you should avoid and which type of fish you absolutely should not be eating.
East River fisherman Miguel Perez fishes all around New York City. He grew up in Spanish Harlem and is a truck driver by trade. He uses his fishing time to hang out with friends. Most of his buddies will have at least one pole in the water or a crabbing basket thrown in.
This water's been cleaning up. Everybody knows that. It looks even cleaner than the Hudson River. The Hudson River, the water's brown, murky, dirty, murky water, you know. And This one, you see how clear it is? Don't you see the fish, how clean he looks? Take a good look at that fish. You tell me that that looks like a dirty fish.
Perez's tackle box holds a printout of the fish that are okay for eating. He got the information from the City Department of Health's website, and he passes out copies to his friends. He says this way, everybody knows what's safe, and they can just keep on fishing. This is Jillian Eugenios in New York.
You're listening to Audiophiles. I'm your host, Ellie Yu. You may have noticed lately that your local watering hole has a lot more options on tap than Butter Coors. That's because microbreweries and craft beers are everywhere these days, especially right here in New York State. In the past 10 years, the industry has almost doubled in size, providing jobs, tax revenue, and really good beer. Here to talk about the ins and outs of running a tiny microbrewery out of an apartment in Brooklyn are Lauren and Joe Grimm of Grimm Ales. Joe, Lauren, welcome to Audiophiles.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Hi, Ellie.
So tell us a little bit about Grimm Ales and, you know, how it got started.
Well, Joe and I have been homebrewers for about 7 years now. We kind of started by just being really interested in yeast and, you know, the transformation of, you know, sugars into alcohol in general. We just have, you know, slowly gotten going over the past 7 years and eventually decided we would start a brewery.
Right. The first version of the brewery, you know, the first iteration of Grimm Ales was actually Lauren and I making beer in our kitchen, and then whenever our friends had like art gallery shows or like, you know, little music shows or whatever, we would go and set up a table and sell the beer that we had made illegally out of like the little bottles that we'd capped ourselves in our apartment. And eventually we decided that we wanted to do it for real.
So tell us about Grimm Ales now. How many gallons of beer are you brewing?
Just to give you a little more information about Grimm Artisanal Ales, we are a nomadic brewery, so we don't own our own equipment. We call up other breweries in the Northeast, ask them if they have time for us to come in for a day and make wort and, you know, leave it on site to ferment over the next 3 or 4 weeks. Right now, we are brewing at a brewery in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and it's a 20-barrel system, which isn't very large for brewery standards, but it's, you know, we make it a different batch every month, and they're all limited edition special beers.
Right. There's about 31 gallons in a barrel, so... that's a very small batch of beer by, you know, the standards of a professional brewery.
So tell me about nomadic brewing. Are you brewing at a different place each month?
Not necessarily, but possibly. We live in Brooklyn, and all of our recipes are developed in, like, our home kitchen. And then whenever we get one that we want to take and make available like on a commercial level, we take that to a brewery that we essentially rent. It could be anywhere, and just talk to them about whether they'll let us do all the things this way or that way. We work it out, you know, and deal with sort of the restrictions that they might have.
So where are you sourcing your ingredients, most of your ingredients?
We like to get it from local suppliers as much as possible. Since we don't have a physical like place to make beer of our own, one of the ways that we enjoy working in more local sourcing is through getting stuff from like the local farmers market, where we bought like 300 pounds of honey from Tremblay Apiaries, which is in Van Etten, New York.
We also work with micro maltery in Massachusetts called Valley Malt. Usually grain is malted in, you know, huge companies in a couple different malteries around the world. And so it's really special that we have a micro maltery so close to us. Andrea Stanley and her husband source greens from New York State and Massachusetts and basically are malting them in their garage in small batches.
So you talked about trying the batches out in your home kitchen first. Tell me how that usually happens, and do you have any stories of, would you not recommend people doing this at home? Or
we totally
I would definitely recommend doing it at home. Home brewing is great. Everybody should get involved. And I think a lot of times, you know, people, it takes a while to make, you know, a great beer at home. You've got to try it a few times. I think a lot of people try it once and they're like, oh, this isn't very good. Maybe I'll just go out and buy a bottle instead. But I think if you get past those moments of, you know, questioning whether your beer is any good or having some bottles that explode, then you'll make good beer and it'll be fun.
Have you had bottles explode?
We have.
We had one.
We had one bottle.
That was many years ago.
Yeah, we've had, I mean, you know, brewing at home for 7 years means we've had a lot of different stories. One time, our carboy kind of overflowed. Well, so it builds, it gets a lot of krausen on top during the fermentation process.
What's krausen?
It's the kind of foam, yeast foam that, you know, forms on the top of your beer when it's fermenting, when there's an active fermentation. So you have these airlocks on your carboy, and basically in the middle of the night, I heard this pop in our living room and went in to find beer and yeast sprayed on the ceiling and everywhere. Joe and I took the mop and we're mopping the ceiling.
So how do you – can you talk a little bit about the science of brewing beer, or is it – or is it purely an art? What's the science behind it?
Well, there's a little bit of both. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's all the same thing. Any kind of alcohol production has to do with yeast taking sugars and devouring them. And a byproduct of that process is that they create the alcohol that we drink. So any kind of alcoholic beverage is going to be made essentially the same way. You get a sugary solution and then introduce the right culture that you want to into it. And as they eat the stuff, they make the alcohol. And then for like a distilled beverage, you would then take that and send it through another layer of processing to make it stronger. But for a beer or a wine, when it's done, it's done.
And there are a lot of different ways that a brewer can influence the flavors and the, you know, aromas and texture of the final beer during the fermentation process. So just by small changes like changing the temperature of the mash, changing the temperature at which your beer is fermenting at, you know, changing the chemistry of your water by adding different, you know, ions, all affect the end flavor that you're going to get from your beer.
I want to talk about sort of the boom in microbreweries in the last, you know, last several years. What do you think's been fueling this?
Well, I think in general, you know, I would say that in the past 20 years, there's been a movement in the U.S. towards, you know, locally grown organic products. And I think that that has driven interest in all areas of, you know, beverages and foods in the U.S. There's just a growing interest in general in, you know, specialty products. And I think that that's, you know, gone into the craft beer movement as well.
I can tell you for us, it has to do with DIY culture in general. Lauren and I really like making things. You know, like when we're at home, Lauren's been like, you're going to brush your teeth with this. It's some toothpaste that I made out of da-da-da. Or like, we're going to make soap today. So, you know, when we first got started doing the stuff, we were just really interested in fermentations. We were making like kimchi and sauerkraut and Russian kvass and mead and things like this. And then when we started to do beer, we were getting better and better results. And it tasted amazing. And we just got really excited and a little bit obsessed with it. Yeah.
And what's it like trying to start your own small business here in the state? I mean, has the state been doing anything to support small breweries here?
Definitely. I mean, as far as, you know, our nomadic brewery goes, you know, there's, you know, a lot of support within the state. They've lowered the, you know, cost of registering labels for smaller breweries. There is a new license called the Farm Brewery License that enables a brewery to operate in the same way that a winery might, where you have, you know, something that you're growing like hops, and then you can have a brewery on site and also sell other people's beers. And that helps, you know, people like us because we get to buy local products to use in our own beers.
Right. We're very into using things from the area whenever we can.
You have a new beer out in November, I hear. Where can our listeners find it?
Well, right now we have out Going Awry. It's a rye Abbey Ale that's 8% ABV. And you can find it in New York City, in Brooklyn, Manhattan, Queens, at craft beer bars like Proletariat and the Owl Farm and Bar Great Harry.
They all have it right now. I think as far as bottle shops go, they have it in Malt and Mold and Eagle Provisions.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll have to leave it here for today. Lauren and Joe, thank you so much for joining us. That was Lauren and Joe Grimm of Grimm Artisanal Ales. Find out more about their beer on our website, audiofilespodcast.com. It's been 2 weeks since Typhoon Haiyan struck the Philippines. Thousands of people are dead and many more remain homeless. Aid is just getting to the most remote areas of the island nation. Here in New York, the Filipino-American community is collecting money and goods to support the relief effort. Mikhail Simmons finds out how one Brooklyn business in Ditmas Park is helping out.
There's oxtail in peanut sauce.
It's a busy night in Chef Romy Dorotan's kitchen.
Grilling also some Chinese eggplant. Can you hear that?
Dorotan is the head chef and owner of the Popoyam restaurant in Brooklyn. After Typhoon Haiyan struck the Philippines, he decided to do what he does best: cook.
There's always a connection between food and helping people.
Tomorrow, he's expecting 120 people for a special brunch. All proceeds will be donated to the nonprofit Gawad Kalinga.
This fundraising creates an occasion for us to bond together and help each other.
Gawad Kalinga means taking care in Tungalog, the national language of the Philippines. The group is known for building free homes in the country's poorest communities. It plans to use the funds to buy food for distribution throughout the affected regions. The next morning, the kitchen staff is once again working while volunteers walk from table to table collecting donations.
I'm J.P. Cortez. I'm from New York. But originally, I'm from Ormoc City, Leyte, one of the hardest hit areas in the Philippines.
Cortez is one of those volunteers whose family was personally affected by the typhoon.
My mom and my dad is there, and I have a brother and a sister also that's living there now, and all my nieces and nephews and my grandma, everybody's there.
With cell towers down and phone lines cut, there was no way for him to know if his family was safe.
It took us 2 days after the storm before we even communicated them. There's no way for us to talk to them, no way for to call them. And finally, on two days after we did, I finally spoke to my dad, and you know, it was tough.
Cortez was relieved to find out everyone had survived, but...
So we lost almost 65,000 heads of chicken. That's we lost everything, the buildings, all the chicken that we have over there, and also the pig farm that we have. And my dad really invested 12 years of his, you know, life before even before retiring to have at least security after retiring, you know, money. But unfortunately now, you know, we lost everything.
Many of the restaurant's regulars decided to help out the typhoon victims.
As soon as this happened, I figured I would check in with the restaurant.
Eileen and her family lived just around the corner.
I did check the blog, the Ditmas Park blog, and that's when we saw that they were doing the benefit. And we made reservations right away because we knew it would be busy.
She was right. A printed sign outside the restaurant read, brunch sold out. Over $7,600 was raised in just 3 hours. At the end of the brunch, Chef Romney Dorotan walked through the bustling restaurant to take a breather.
Romney, would you say it's a success so far?
Yes, very good. I'm very happy today. People seem to be very happy and giving, very generous today. People are feeling very generous.
He couldn't stop smiling. He plans to throw another brunch next week. Same time, same place. This is Mikhail Simmons in Brooklyn, New York.
I'm Ellie Yu. You're listening to Audiophiles. In the early 90s, the city developed a program to help disabled veteran street vendors sell their goods in the busiest parts of town. It's helped in many ways, but it's also created some new problems. Vendors competing with each other for these prime spots. Topher Forges has more in this episode of City in Demand.
Derek Wilmot sits in a fold-out chair on the north side of Battery Park. He wears a cap with Vietnam veterans stitched in big yellow letters across the front. He served from 71 to 72, and he suffers from PTSD.
These two is difficult. This one is high blood pressure. This one is a mood, like bipolar. I'm always up, I'm always down. I don't have a medium, okay? And then at night, I take two Trazodone for me not to dream about my past.
About 10 feet across from him, the vendor Wilmot has been working with this week preps his cart to sell kebabs and pretzels. They've worked out a deal. The vendor makes all the food and handles the money. Wilmot provides the vending permit, a special type of permit that gives disabled veterans access to this part of the city, where tourists are most likely to hand out cash. In exchange for the permit, Wilmot gets $150 at the end of the day.
I enjoy it. Life is good. I got a family. I used to be an addict. 18 years. Drugging, drinking. Not doing it no more.
Around 10 a.m., another vendor pulls up and parks his cart right next to Wilmot's.
See, now here come these guys. They want to rough us off for the spot. It's going to be a big fight now today.
He's seen this play out before. It's about his permit. Wilmot has a yellow, which means he can vend everywhere in the city except for Midtown. That's reserved for the blues. There's also a number system for each color.
If his number is lower than mine, that means he could get the spot. But respect is respect. If I've been here early and I'm being there number one, you're supposed to allow me whatever, you know?
A younger vet, a tall man in glasses and a beanie, comes over to ask Wilmot to move. It doesn't go well.
You come stepping in front of me. You didn't even say good morning.
I asked you a question. What's going on, boss? I said, what's going on, boss?
I'm 62 years old.
That's the way
you
I talk.
Said, sir.
Sir? Who are you, my pops?
Wilmot calls the police.
Yes, because he got a youngster disrespecting me, and I'm doing my job. You know, they didn't want us to move, and they're threatening us, and they're threatening us.
They show up about 15 minutes later.
It's first come, first serve. That's how it's been with the spots.
Yeah. As far as I knew it.
That's how it goes. It's the lowest number gets the spot. That's how it's always been for years now.
After a few more words, the police give the final say. Wilmot's cart stays. Then the parks department shows up, and after a few minutes, the rules change again.
We got to move because we got a lower number now.
The fact is, Wilmot's permit is part of a complex and confusing system, vendor laws.
It doesn't operate like as a unified legal system. It operates as just kind of a spaghetti of different laws just interacting in ways that no one can predict in many instances.
Ryan Devlin is a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice.
The current system as it exists today was a reaction to the fact that there was basically for a little while, there was sort of a Wild West atmosphere. So this current program is basically tantamount to sort of trying to stop this sort of wild, wild west atmosphere of anybody can vend anywhere at any time.
The yellow and blue permit program started in 1990 when the streets of Midtown were flooded with vendors, many of them vets. The businesses wanted all of the vendors out, but this was the 90s, the Gulf War, and policymakers feared that putting so many vets out of work would make them look bad.
It was not at all a charitable act by the city. It was more of a, how can we limit the amount of vendors without completely looking like anti-veteran?
So they struck a deal. 60 blue licenses in Midtown. Those vending the longest got those permits. Yellows for everyone else. And the number system to keep everyone in line. Devlin says the system, by nature, pits vets against each other.
You know, the Midtown box creates a big divide.
Vets on the inside versus vets on the outside. Henry Irby is on the inside.
I used to have a couple of vending carts. Things went bad for me. Wasn't making no money. So I went to work for a guy named Gus, who paid me very well. I stayed with him for about 5 years. I made $300 to $600 a day with him every day.
Irby has a blue permit, the kind that lets you vend in the most coveted spot in New York City, Midtown. Plus, his number is 14, one of the lowest possible. For non-veteran vendors, his permit might as well be gold. He's been renting it out to Charlie for the past year.
Just set it up and have a blue. You ain't got no problem.
Irby has a pretty sweet deal, but Derek Wilmot has some tricks up his sleeve as well. Back at Battery Park, Wilmot makes his way to a new location, actually just right around the corner from where he was before. Still, he's not planning on going quietly. He's thinking about calling another vet with an even lower number to help him reclaim his first spot.
No, and you get under 100, I got somebody under 10 that come and take a spot, that I'll pay him out of my pocket. That's to be there, to show that we got the spot.
It's a daily game in the city. Numbers, colors, permits. Disabled veteran vendors use these pieces to best one another in a game where only a few know the rules. For City in Demand, I'm Topher Forges.
For more from the City in Demand series, you can check out City in Demand on Facebook. In the little town of Portchester, just north of the Bronx, demographics are changing. The town has become a hub for Westchester's day laborer community in recent years. Reporter Ronald Chavez has been talking to workers there and is here now to talk with us. Hi, Ronald.
Hi, good to be here.
So I know there's a big community of day laborers in Portchester. Has it always been this way?
Well, some of the institutions there were established by Italian immigrants in the middle of the 20th century. And after years of being really an Italian town, Portchester has become a community where lots of people from Mexico or Central or South America have settled. Almost 60% of the population identifies as Hispanic. And when you walk the streets, you can really feel it. Wherever you walk, there really are Hispanic restaurants. You can see them everywhere, really. But I spoke to Modesto Armenteros. He's a day laborer, but he's from Portchester. The change has really taken him by surprise. This is what he told me.
I was born here about 10 years ago. There was maybe you see three Mexicans in all of Portchester. I came back, you know, a year ago, and I was like, what happened?
So what did happen?
Well, Portchester is next to Greenwich and Harrison. It's a few train stops from Stamford. It's near all these towns where very wealthy people live, which also means there's a lot of work available for daily laborers like gardening and carpentry. There used to be a trend where people would come up only in the summer when there's more work and leave in the winter. But that's not happening as much anymore. I visited the Don Bosco Community Center. They organize workers, and it's where a lot of the workers come to get picked up. One of them, Manuel O, he didn't want to give me his last name, but he said people who come are intent on bringing their families and staying year-round. So what he's saying here is Hispanic people, they send money back, they eat here, and they pay rent here. Some of them make roots here, they get married, they have kids. They don't think about going back. He's saying they grow to love the country.
So what does this mean? What is the significance of what's happening in Portchester?
Well, whether this little town succeeds here could tell us a lot about what it means to enter our economy as an immigrant. What's it like to come here as an immigrant working these kinds of jobs versus, say, 15, 20 years ago? Can you still come into this country and do okay, even if a lot of old jobs on pastures or factories aren't there anymore?
Got it. Well, thank you, Ronald.
Thanks for having me.
To hear the full story from Ronald Chavez about day laborers in Portchester, New York, go to our website, audiofilespodcast.com. That's audiofiles with an F, audiofilespodcast.com.
All right. I know this isn't any fun to talk about, but we should. So, who's going to do what? Flashlights?
Nowhere to be found.
Batteries?
Dead.
Great. Emergency supply kits?
Not packed.
No. What about blankets?
We have an old towel.
Good enough. Cell phones?
May not work.
Emergency water?
Not a drop.
And what about food?
Nope.
Perfect. We all know where we're meeting if we're separated, yeah?
The library!
Aunt Joan's house.
The bus stop.
Great. And I'll be waiting here wondering where you all are. Sounds like we don't have a plan. Who's up for mini golf?
Winging it is not an emergency plan. Make sure your kids know what to do during an emergency. Who to call, where to meet, what to pack. Visit ready.gov/kids for tips and information. A public service announcement brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
I like that it's an international mecca. People from all over the world come here, and they get the photo op of the guitar player at Grand Central Station, so I'm a bit of a tourist attraction. I am Robert Maximus Bridgewell, and you're listening to Audio Files.
Audio Files will be tackling stage fright when we produce our show live at the Jalopy Theater in Brooklyn on Friday, December 6th at 6 p.m. The show will feature live music, storytelling, interviews, and even a trivia game where you can participate. So join us at the Jalopy Theater on December 6th when Audio Files battle stage fright. For more information, go to our website, audiofilespodcast.com. I'm Ellie Yu, and this is Audio Files. In the small town of Clarkston, Georgia, 10 miles east of Atlanta, an unlikely partnership has sparked between one of the town's oldest residents and one of the town's newest. I had the chance to travel to Georgia last month, where I got to witness this unique relationship firsthand. 52-year-old Bishnu Chetri weaves in and out of a garden full of waist-high marigolds, towering okra plants, and bunches of bright little red peppers. She speaks to her husband in Nepali. Together, they farm this land, which is about an acre wide and lined with forest trees. The land here belongs to 89-year-old Hugh Spivey, whose house is just 100 feet from the farm. He drives up on his golf cart and warmly greets Chetri.
Hello, good looking.
Good looking.
Spivey's lived in this town his whole life, his parents too, and his grandparents.
This land has been in my name, I mean, 7 generations.
And for as long as he can remember, his family's been farming this 30-acre plot.
We've always farmed that out. We had cows on it for a while. Grandpa, he had a blacksmith shop. He had a grist mill, a sawmill.
But he hasn't tilled it in a while. And in March, for the first time ever, he offered a piece of that land to the Chetris.
This is the first year that we have let that land out there go to use. Benny got connected with these people.
Benny is his son, Ben Spivey. Ben met Bishnu's son, Bikesh Chetri, earlier this year through an entrepreneurial program at a local nonprofit. Bikesh Chetri came with a business plan to try to grow marigolds.
I had this idea because no one was growing this here. And I looked around, I went to Pikes, to other nurseries, and no one had them. And I thought, why not grow?
The bright orange buds are used as garlands in Hindu ceremonies, and there's a large Bhutanese population and Hindu community in this part of Georgia.
We wear it around our neck. It's a symbol of love, longevity, all of those feelings.
For Ben Spivey, he wanted to see if they could generate some revenue from his dad's unused land, and he thought Bikesh's plan would meet a demand in the community.
Well, he was introduced to me, and I said, hey, that's great. We got a little plant, a little property. Let's put together Marigold Farm and see how well you guys do this year. We can do this. This won't be a big problem.
Ben said they could use the Spivey land for free, and they'd be able to split the profits. The agreement has been a bright spot in what has been a difficult journey for Bikesh Chetri and his family. His father, who picks through the marigolds today, was in jail for 2 years because he protested against the Bhutanese government.
It's really bad. We did not know what happened to him and all of that. There was no information shared. I still remember the day when I went to see him get released, and he had this long, long beard.
After his father was released, Bikesh Chetri lived in a refugee camp in Nepal for more than a decade. 4 years ago, Bikesh and his wife and daughter resettled in the U.S. His parents joined him 2 years later.
It changed everything, living in the refugee camp, not having hope, with life being the way it was, not knowing what will happen tomorrow, what education we can give to our children. We had none of those. And then we come to this country, and then we buy a house. You know, my friends have businesses. My children go to grade school. I know they have a very good future. Everything just changed overnight.
The Spiveys are one of the few American friends they've made here. Their relationship has moved beyond just business. Ben Spivey refers to Bishnu Chetri as family.
We call her Amma, as in my, your grandmother, mother of, whatever. And so this is my Amma's garden.
Together from opposite sides of the world, here they're trying to build somewhat of a new future together. This year, some marigolds didn't grow as well as others. They haven't gotten the harvest they planned for. But they've kept seeds from the good plants this season for next year. For Audiophiles, I'm Ellie Yu. Today on the show, we're talking about pastures of plenty. And now we're heading from a pasture in Georgia to one in our own backyard. 57-year-old Laura Shapiro is a furniture maker who lives on a horse farm in Shokan, New York. And while she got her start in the big city, she soon traded the din of the city for acres of woods and a stable of horses. For the past 25 years, that's all she's had. Audiophiles reporter Alex Einman ventured upstate to hear about the city mouse, country mouse, transformation.
I was living in Dumbo in a little apartment in Vinegar Hill. My son Fraser was born in Beekman Hospital. So I think my son was about 3 years old, and I was getting sick of the environment. I think it was important that he be in the woods and around animals. I often bring my camera out here because I never know what I'm going to see. It could be a glint of light on the trees up there, or some creature or other, a bear, a hawk. I live for those moments, you know. I run towards these moments. In 1989, we bought a house in Saugerties by the mountain. That was the beginning of a whole new chapter. It was exactly what I wanted it to be, except that there were neighbors that we had it that. When we first moved in, we're always yelling at the dog or the kid to, you know, get out of here. I need time alone, and I don't want distractions. Yeah, this is the quietest it's been in a while. I moved to Saugerties in 89. Having horses in the area, you sort of just know what's available. I had been here a long, long time ago. You know, I just loved the farm. You know, it just felt really good. So June of 2006, I was here. My two horses were here.
This is the barn. Shay is over here. She's 14, and I got her when she was 10 months old. She's the horse I ride. When I need to get away from home and in the woods, this is the horse that I go with. And we just have, we understand each other, I think.
In the years that I've lived here, I think I've gone back to the city a handful of times, a couple of times to see my son. If anything, I'd rather be further away from civilization as it is right now.
Well, the farm, when you come in, it's pretty much wide open. There are paddocks that don't have any trees in them. But around the paddocks, all the way around 360 degrees, are the woods.
I was just in love with the farm and not seeing anybody from, you know, my porch, just surrounded by trees and fields, and just loved it and have loved it ever since, you know. I mean, I could stay here forever. I moved up here and never looked back.
I want a sheep, I want to give me a good night's sleep, living in a home in the heart of the country.
That was produced by reporter Alex Eidman. You're listening to Audio Files, and I'm Ellie Yu. The bluegrass Americana group Eastbound Jesus hails from Greenwich, a town of 5,000 in upstate New York. But even though the band has small town roots, they've been able to attract a big time following through their energetic live shows. We have Eastbound Jesus in our studio today. Guys, welcome.
Hey, thank you.
So I know you'll be starting us off with a cover that you learned just for us. This is Eastbound Jesus performing Woody Guthrie's Pastors of Plenty live on Audio Files.
It's a mighty hard road that my poor hands have hoed. My poor feet have traveled a high dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rode. Your deserts were hot and your mountains were cold. I worked in your orchards of peaches and prunes. I slept on the ground in the light of the moon. On the edge of the city, you'll see us and then we'll come with the dust and we'll go with the wind. California, Arizona, I harvest your crops. Well, it's north up to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine. To set on your table your light sparkling wine. Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground. From the Grand Coulee Dam where the waters run down. Every state in the Union us migrants have been. We'll work in this fight and we'll fight till we win. It's always we ramble this river and I. All along your green valley I work till I die. My land I'll defend with my life if it be. Cause my pastures of plenty must always be free. My pastures of plenty must always be free.
That was Eastbound Jesus covering Pastors of Plenty. Eastbound Jesus is usually a six-piece band, but we have a pared-down version of the group with us today. Adam Brockway is on the guitar and vocals, and Luke Anderson is on the banjo. So how is learning this song for you guys? Are you familiar with Woody Guthrie's music?
Yeah, Luke's more familiar than I am, but we got together last night, actually, and sat down and worked on it for about 10 or 11 minutes. And it was pretty easy. It's all one chord, really, so it was pretty simple. I have a cheat sheet here in front of me with the lyrics, but I tried to memorize them all.
Luke, has Woody Guthrie inspired your music at all?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely got into folk music when I was around the time when I was listening to a lot of him. And I first started with guitar, and I was listening to a ton of his music, and as well as other people like him. So yeah, he has inspired me big time.
You guys call your brand of music Northern Rock. What does that mean?
Luke?
It's the northern equivalent of southern rock.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's about a lot more cold weather.
What sort of themes are in there?
Well, we sing about the cold a lot. We sing about changes in the weather, and we just sing about North Country life in general, small town life, whatever's going on around us. We sing about a little bit of everything, just like everybody else. We call it Northern Rock because we didn't know what else to call it, really.
And that's what your latest album is called, correct?
Yeah.
When is that coming out?
It came out in April.
Yeah. And how was the recording process?
It was pretty simple, really. We record at Edie Road Studio in Greenwich, New York. Really nice studio. A friend of mine, Chris Roberson, is our engineer. And it was really slick. We went in ready to go. We had all our songs written and ready, and we did it in a couple of weekends. And it was easy.
Speaking of, can we hear one of your songs?
Sure. We're going to do one off of our first record. This is the first song that we ever wrote as a group. It's called Rundown.
One, two, three.
Be hard road, this one I'm on. It's been so long, I wandered round in this old town like I belong. But everyone's gone crazy, everyone but me. And why don't they see if it all slowed down? It just might take more seriously. But I'm a little run down, and I'm on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Choice of words. I gotta get to my job. I gotta make my pay. Well, that's what they say, but who the hell are they to tell me how to spend my day? In all walks of life, they ain't all the same. Why should I change? If you don't agree, then you just might be the one I blame. That I'm a little run down, and I'm on the verge of a nervous breakdown, and a poor choice of words. Well, I've come a long way, and I've learned to grow. I've come to know there's just some shit I'll never get. It's the way it goes, and it's a big old world full of crazy things. I just play my strings and write it down and get it out in the songs I sing. Cause I'm a little run down, and I'm on the verge of a nervous breakdown and a poor choice of words. Yeah, I'm a little run down.
That was Rundown by Eastbound Jesus. I want to talk a little bit about how your band sort of got together and the origin of your band. How did you guys start off?
Well, we all grew up in the same little town of Greenwich, and we all knew each other. Luke and I used to ride the school bus together, and his brother, who's also in the band. And we've all just known each other through music and just in general. And we all had other bands that kind of fell apart at the same time. And Luke's brother, Carl, who plays drums for us, he contacted me and said that he had a kick drum and he was buying a snare drum and he wanted to learn how to play the drums and he thought we should jam. So we gathered a few of us together and we met up at a barn one night
and started writing songs, and it just, we hit it off quick and just kept doing it.
What was your first show like?
What was our first show?
The Hootenanny?
Yeah, the first show was fun. It was a Hootenanny out in the town next to us, Easton, and it was like in the middle of nowhere, and it was awesome. It was a wild time. It was a lot of fun.
Where do you sort of get your influence from? What sort of music?
We get our influences from all over the place. I think I'd say half the band are big Deadheads. They were in a band that played
used
a lot
to be.
Of... Used to be big Deadheads. I'd say we still are. But we get it from all over the place. We listen to a lot of Michael Jackson, listen to a lot of like the old outlaw country guys like Waylon Jennings, Merle Haggard, and all them, as well as all the contemporary rock and roll, too.
And where do you see yourselves fitting in with the recent wave of Americana bands like Mumford & Sons and the Avett Brothers?
I don't know. I think we're different from those bands. I mean, I we're doing our own thing, and I mean, we do have a banjo, but other than that, I don't see a whole lot of similarity. You know, we just kind of do our own thing, whatever sounds good to us, and we get labeled a lot of different things: country, Americana. I think that's why we chose Northern Rock, because we don't want to get stuck in any particular genre with any group of bands.
Now, I have to ask you about your name, Eastbound Jesus. Where did that come from?
It was very random.
Yeah, we were having a conversation late one night. We were talking about somebody who lives in the middle of nowhere, and our bassist said, yeah, he lives out in East Jesus somewhere. We were like, oh, East Jesus, that's got a good ring to it. So we just made it into Eastbound Jesus.
Yeah. Have people misinterpreted your name at all?
Yes, yeah, it happens now and then. People have called us out for being sacrilegious or such. We don't intend to be. We're all faithful people to an extent. We don't all go to church every Sunday, but
I think we've definitely been mistaken for being a religious band as well.
Yeah, definitely.
A bunch of times.
People ask us all the time if we're a Christian band.
And can we hear another song from you?
Sure. Yeah.
This is called Talking to John About the Weather. Here we go. John about the weather, said it's really getting better, and I'm doing all right too. It's 43 degrees in December, man, how the hell are you? Johnny's reaching down in his pocket, he says, boy, you gotta watch it, or they'll steal your last dime. I'm working on a way I can stop it, but otherwise I'm fine. Ain't it hard to find a sound that suits a northern town when it's not snowing? And ain't it hard for you to sing about the whiskey that you drank when it's not flowing? And ain't it hard down in the dirt when you're buried in the herd and you're trying to find a word just to show it? And ain't it hard to keep on rolling? Single day she's been calling, telling me she's falling away from what's real. Nothing I can say helps at all, but I know just how she feels. And I've been on both sides of the water, seen 100 daughters crying just like you. And they all ran away like mama taught them, why don't you go too? Ain't it hard to find a sound that suits a northern town when it's not snowing? And ain't it hard for you to sing about the whiskey that you drank when it's not flowing?
made it hard down in the dirt when you're buried in the herd and you're trying to find a word just to show it. And ain't it hard to keep on rolling? Sound that suits a northern town when it's not snowing. And ain't it hard for you to sing about the whiskey that you drank when it's not flowing? And ain't it hard down in the dirt when you're buried in the herd and you're trying to find a word just to show it?
You've been listening to Audiophiles. This show was produced by Mary Eileen Croke. Tiffany Kamhai is our assistant producer, and Ronald Chavez is our online producer. Our engineer is Chad Bernhard. I'm Ellie Yu. Thanks for listening.
Some calling.